This was the sound of a Gemini Titan rocket lifting off from its pad at Cape Kennedy. It was probably the most dramatic sound of 1965. But there was another sound, less compelling, but possibly even more significant.
It was the sound of water being wasted. A dripping faucet can be annoying, especially in the middle of the night. But what used to be a minor irritation was seen in 1965 as a major disaster. There simply wasn't enough water.
By the late 1970s, our requirements for fresh water will overtake our supply. At the present time, we use about 355 billion gallons of water per day. The technically available supply, that is available in the sense that it's where you need it, when you need it, is about 550 billion gallons of water per day. By 1980, the demand will exceed that supply, and by the year 2000, only 35 years away, we will need over 1,000 billion gallons of water per day, and the supply will be the same.
The villains were the westerlies, those high-altitude winds that blow roughly from southwest to northeast and bring rain to the heartlands, to Kansas and Missouri and Michigan and the rocky little farms of New England. In 1961, these westerlies began to shift subtly to the north. The movement continued until, by 1965, they were about 500 miles off course, and there was a parched area that stretched from Maryland to Maine. Government engineers drew up plans for pumping water from one place to another, but it was clear that these were stopgap measures. There simply wasn't enough water, and if all the leaking faucets in the country were repaired, there still wouldn't be enough.
On Saturday, September 4th, Hurricane Betsy, newly born and vicious, moved to within 360 miles of Cape Kennedy. Indications were it would go north and lose itself in the North Atlantic. Indications were wrong. The next day, it headed south and hit Nassau. Miami was next, and then New Orleans. When Betsy finally drifted away and quietly expired, she left behind 100 dead and $1 billion damaged. The Weather Bureau, in an uncharacteristic and somewhat sentimental gesture, announced it would retire the name Betsy for 10 years. This, they said, was because of her infamy.
A human whirlwind of sorts stunned the sports world and provided 1965's only true sports hero complete with triumph over adversity. Sandy Koufax, a lean, intensive, left-handed pitcher, dominated baseball, pitching a perfect game in September, establishing a major league record for strikeouts later that month, then almost single-handedly leading the Los Angeles Dodgers to a seventh-game victory over Minnesota in the World Series. This, despite a painful arthritic condition in Koufax's powerful pitching arm.
In Houston, they painted the ceiling of the Astrodome an off-white so outfielders could spot the pop flies. Professional football got even bigger with the Green Bay Packers, the best of the lot, and Cassius Clay, who beat Sonny Liston again, and Floyd Patterson, said afterward just about what you'd expect him to say.
I'm trying to get them to legalize it where, and sanctionize it and authorize it where I can fight about three men in one night. Because no one man really, now laying all jokes aside, no one man on earth is even fast enough to catch me. He's not fast enough to hit me. There's just nobody around. Floyd was the fastest next to me, and I played, beat him at will. You don't have a man in the world today to give me a show.
And Casey Stengel, unyielding and incomprehensible still, retired from baseball and in a sudden gesture gave his uniform with the venerable number 37, humbling New York Mets.
There is the uniform 37, and you're going to receive it for the club, whether it's going to be in your behalf or the club's behalf. I certainly want to thank you for the years of service I've had under your leadership.
There were more books that year with more four-letter words than ever before. But a lot of people were buying books with polysyllabic words. Samuel Eliot Morrison's The Oxford History of the American People was important and probably memorable. And a number of writers, of course, were concerned, as always, with the South and the Civil War, toiling, as somebody said, in the fields of Catton. Bruce Catton, by the way, made his contribution with Never Call Retreat.
It was not a memorable year for the theater. There were plenty of comedies and musicals, but no serious play survived the Broadway season. There was one development that deserves at least a footnote, I suppose, in our history. Burlesque, banned in New York City since LaGuardia, made a comeback. This incident in the cultural revival of our times brought a comment from a young lady, a frequent performer in burlesque whose name, she insists, is Tempest Storm.
My work is very artistic. When I'm on stage, I belong to the public. I never take my work home with me.
There was another exotic dancer this year who performed one night for a number of policemen who were celebrating, if memory serves, the retirement of one of their members. There was an unfortunate development, and the young lady spoke to newsmen about it more in sorrow than anger.
I had a girlfriend along with me who happens to be an exceptional oriental dancer, better known as a belly dancer. We went back to the dressing room to get dressed, and we discovered that her pants were missing, and $20 was taken from me. As far as the money is concerned, it hasn't been returned, nor the pants.
And then, on the clear, moonlit evening of November 9th, just after nightfall, the impossible happened.
Virtually all of New York City was blacked out at 5:28 p.m. Eastern Standard Time tonight by a power failure. Reports indicated that parts of Westchester and Eastern New York State were also affected.
Westchester, New York, Albany, New York, Binghamton, New York, and from Providence, Rhode Island. All of New York State appeared to be out of power. Robert Jenna, the president of
reporting New York City, the Transit Authority, says as many as 150,000 persons might be stranded in the city's subways.
It was as though suddenly the 20th century had been repealed.
Planes in the air were unable to land, and those on the ground were unable to take off. Travel
there were farmers who, for the first time in their lives, milked a cow by hand. Kerosene lamps lost their quaintness and were put back to work.
States where the lights went off included New York, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, Connecticut.
Thousands of commuters were
on New York's Park Avenue, hostesses in Dior dresses cooked dinner in the fireplace.
Motionless without electric power in the stations and in Times Square.
Television sets blinked off, and news-hungry adults took the transistor radios away from teenagers whose rock and roll music had been replaced by blackout bulletins.
Maybe one just south of Niagara in upstate New York. There was a sudden, instantaneous power cutoff, or possibly a power surge.
For the record, the trouble was caused by a relay in a Canadian power plant 4 miles north of Niagara Falls.
Greetings to you, America. The first power to set foot upon your land blesses you with all his heart.
It was October 4th, shortly after 9:30 in the morning. Pope Paul VI had just arrived in New York on a historic flight from Rome.
He planted the cross of Christ in his blessed soil. May the cross of blessing, which we now place over your skies and your land, preserve those gifts which Christ gave you and guaranteed to you: peace, comfort, freedom, justice, and above all, the vision of life in the hope of immortality. God bless this land of yours.
It is probably safe to say that never before was one single man seen in one single day by so many people.
There were 630,000 people who saw him as his car moved through Queens to Manhattan. On Third Avenue, there were signs greeting him in Italian and Spanish. He saw Harlem briefly and the towers of Fifth Avenue. At St. Patrick's Cathedral, 165,000 people awaited his arrival.
Walking down the center aisle, giving his blessing to the 5,000 assembled here, all standing of course, is Pope Paul VI, as the organ plays the papal march, Silver Trumpets by Viviani. With both hands, His Holiness is giving his blessing. and applause wells from this huge hall on all sides, echoing from its 112 feet height.
It was not a state visit to the United States, but there was a brief meeting with President Johnson and Vice President Humphrey at the Waldorf Astoria. At 3 p.m., he left Cardinal Spellman's residence for his visit to the United Nations.
Jamais plus les uns contre les autres. Jamais plus jamais.
Not the ones against the others. Never again. Never more. The hottest voice rose to stress the urgency of his message.
Jamais plus la guerre, jamais plus la guerre. C'est la paix. La paix. Il doit...
And again, his words were measured. No more war. War never again. Peace.
At about 8:30, the Pope, not yet showing the sign of fatigue that came later, arrived at Yankee Stadium. As one enthusiastic announcer put it, he is standing on second base. Nearly 100,000 people jammed the stadium for the papal mass.
Lord, have mercy.
Lord, have mercy.
Lord, have mercy. Christ, have mercy.
Christ, have mercy.
Lord, have mercy.
Lord, have mercy.
Lord, have mercy. Dominus vobiscum.
There was a final visit at the Vatican Pavilion at the World's Fair, and then at 11:30 p.m. he was airborne again. The pilot flew up the river so that the Pope could see the lights of the city and then banked around and headed for Rome. The pilot, by the way, was a Presbyterian.
Other events in other lands made their marks on 1965's history. The communist Chinese exploded their second atomic bomb and bragged about it. Fidel Castro, for reasons not clear, relaxed his ban and allowed Cubans who wished to migrate to the United States. The very young and the very old had priority. Draft-age males were not included.
In the Atlantic Ocean on November 13th, the cruise ship Yarmouth Castle caught fire and sank with a loss of 89 lives. On December 19th, Charles de Gaulle won a runoff election to a second 7-year term as President of France, but only when he abandoned his aloof austerity and took to television after his failure to gain an absolute majority in the earlier presidential elections.
India and Pakistan fought an ugly little war in the north. On November 11th, a white minority government of Britain's African colony, Rhodesia, in a document that sounded like the American Declaration of Independence, proclaimed itself an independent nation. Expectedly, in these times, the issue was racial. And on April 24th, violence came to the Dominican Republic. It's a small country, 3 million people, but its troubles have been bigger than the country. The 30-year reign of dictator Rafael Trujillo didn't help at all. And very few Americans were disturbed when he was assassinated in 1961. Chaos followed, as it usually does when a dictator is killed, and in April a military coup knocked over the civilian government. On the 27th, about 1,000 Americans were evacuated, and the next day President Johnson ordered American troops in to protect, he said, the Americans still there. Other Latin American governments sent troops, and it was explained that the operation was primarily one of containment, specifically to contain the communists. It was an odd war in an odd country, but to the Marines there, it was just like any other war that any of us can remember.
What have they got down there, Sergeant? How many men have been hit?
Two.
One may be dead. I don't know. He dropped off.
Get out of.
How many men are down there?
I don't know.
There's a patrol coming back.
About 6 of them.
And they got hit.
All of them out of here. Evacuated out of here?
What?
You want him evacuated out of here?
I'll take care of him.
Huh?
Oh, hell,
do you have a vehicle to get him out of here?
Hey, look, they're going to need some more goddamn help. Get him down there.
Bad.
Hey!
How many men down there, Sergeant? There's a patrol down there.
Hey, Sergeant Harrison, get some help down there for that Kelly's pin down there, too.
All they got to do is get on the phone. We can't move from here.
Well, goddamn it, get somebody on the phone then. There's about 8 men pinned down there.
Platoon down there?
Oh, where's this driver?
No, we don't have to. They had a couple people down there. And they got shot. Yeah, he's out. He's out. He's dead.
Spacecraft. Tom Stafford advises in the calmest voice I think we've ever heard that there are 120 feet apart and Let's try to get some additional conversation from them.
6 and 7 Hawaii will be standing by if you have anything for them.
Roger. Just send them up here, that's all.
Call a policeman.
The date was December 15th. And four United States astronauts, hurtling at 17,500 miles an hour above the Earth, were pulling off the most exciting American achievement of the space race.
It might be the fiberglass approximately 10 to 15 feet long.
The separation plane for the booster, right?
Affirmative.
That's exactly where you have one, too. It really belted around there when you were firing your thrusters.
Command pilot Walter Schirra of Gemini 6 talks with the crewman of sister ship Gemini 7 and ground controllers as they accomplish the first rendezvous in space.
Ask them what their range is now.
Six, what's your range?
20 feet.
Roger. 20 feet, mate. We did it.
We did it. Later, safely down after a textbook Atlantic landing, Schirra calmly explained how he did it.
The first time we saw spacecraft 7 was at 54 miles slant range. This is when we started doing our work. And from there on, it was a case of maintaining very small rates as we closed, till finally we were, as Tom was quoted at least saying, at 120 feet sitting. His statement really was 120 feet steady. And this was our real proud moment. 7 was leading us in orbit in the attitude we call BEF, which is blunt end forward, and we were in the attitude of SEF, or small end forward. And this is the nose-to-nose routine, and as a result of this, we got our complete confidence up and did close to about 1 foot in this position.
Now that was the end of our busiest year in space. Pictures transmitted back across the 140 million miles between us and Mars. They showed a very thin atmosphere on the planet, but the old argument about the possibility of life on Mars was undiminished.
Jimmy 4, Houston, Cap Cobb.
Hey, Cobb, I don't know if you're ready, but we're right over Houston. Look at the...
On June 3rd, Gemini 4 went into orbit.
Gemini 4?
Aboard were Major James A. McDivitt and Major Edward H. White. And on this flight, for the first time, an American, Major White, stepped out and floated in space. It took years and millions of dollars to put a man alone in space, and as it turned out, it was almost as hard to get him back.
Gemini 4, Houston.
Is that right? Well, I've taken a lot, but they're not very good. You're in too close for most of them. I finally put the focus down to about 8 feet or so.
Gemini 4, Houston.
See what the flight director's got to say.
What did he say?
The flight director says get back in.
Well, this is Jim. What got any message for us?
Gemini 4, get back in.
Okay. I don't know. We're coming over to the west,
Stanley.
I want you to come back in now.
Roger. We've been trying to talk to you for a while here.
No, back in. Come on. We still got 3.5 more days to go, buddy. I'm coming. Okay.
Gemini 3, 4, and 5, like clockwork, 60 days apart. Then 7 and 6 in a dual flight, all manned, all successful. For the first time since October 1957 and the first Soviet Sputnik, the United States had reason to feel it was at least in the same space league with the Russians, and perhaps well in the lead. To listen to the voices of the astronauts was almost like listening to the future. Almost. For even in space, some vestiges of the past survive.
Gemini 7, this is Gemini 6. We have an object, looks like a satellite, going from north to south, probably in a polar orbit. He's in a very low trajectory, traveling from north to south, and has a very high flightness rate.
A playful Wally Schirra, the rendezvous now a page in history, radios that he's in contact with a mysterious flying object near his Gemini 6 in the cold December skies.
You're too much, Six.
This dark side of the wall shows itself in its most abhorrent and dangerous form in Southeast Asia. There, the year is ending with war in Vietnam, a war more violent.
Jingle bells from outer space. And a plea for peace from the United Nations. That was how man approached Christmas 1965.
More harmful to relations among the great powers, and more perilous to the whole world than at any other time during the generation of conflict which that country has known. This war must be stopped. In its place, let there be, in the words of the recent appeal by Pope Paul VI, an immediate truce, to be followed by reflection, negotiation, and finally, peace.
UN Secretary General U Thant was only one of a score of diplomats, mostly American, who embarked on an intensive peace offensive at year's end. President Johnson sent a team of American troubleshooters to Moscow, Rome, Paris, Belgrade, Ottawa, London, Tokyo, Manila, every possible capital where contacts, however tenuous, might be made with the leadership of the jungle enemy in Vietnam. But by the end of the year, there was no known contact, no audible answer to the American peace overtures, beyond a repetition of the old charges of fraud and trickery.
And suddenly, almost, the year was running out. A young man named John Lindsay was elected mayor of New York, the first Republican to be elected in 20 years. Even before taking office, his troubles began. A man named Mike Quill, who heads the Transport Workers Union, wanted a new contract with more money and a shorter week.
We don't need the mayor to settle this. He made such an ass of himself yesterday over a period of 15 hours that between himself and John B. Oakes and his little handy men who write the editorials for the New York Times, that the people of this city have a strike. They're right in the center of it now, and let them try to get out of it.
One more voice in the cacophony of voices of 1965.
To the transit authority.
That's close to 293.32
of 2.95. Today, the world is facing a population crisis. In my
number four was play it being a homosexual. Number five, you can get a note from...
Men have a very important mission, to make the world safe for our pickets.
Out here in Washington, we look forward with great pleasure to meeting...
Delivers 2-2 to Bob Allison. Swung on and missed. Allison is out. Colfax strikes out number 10.
Jamais plus les uns contre les autres. Jamais plus jamais.
Frank, it looks like it comes out at the separation plate. It might be the fiberglass.
Is our world gone? We say farewell. Is a new world coming? We welcome it. And we will bend it to the hopes of man.
Is our world gone? The answer, of course, must be yes. Old values challenged. Old truths held up to the light and examined for weakness. Young people saying things that we never said, and doing things that we never did. And, as always in such times, the guidepost to the future was in the past. It is part of our glory that those who have left us leave their wisdom behind for all who must walk the new roads.
Nothing is final. Change is unceasing. And it is very likely that mankind has a lot more to learn before they come to their journey's end. We might even find ourselves in a few years moving along a broad, smooth causeway of peace and plenty instead of roaming and peering round along the rim of hell. Thus we may, by patience, courage, and in orderly progression, reach someday, with God's blessing, the shelter of a calmer and kindlier age.